Across the nation.
Yes, we are carried in all 50 states, and we'll go international soon. Good morning. You are in the Senate Education and General Government Committee. If you haven't already figured that out, we're the goofiest committee so far this session, but we actually know what we are doing. It is 8:20. We're a few minutes late getting started. I do want to remind you to please turn off your cell phone, your BlackBerries, and your computers. If you turn on your computer, you must do it outside because it makes a noise when it turns on. Someone did that last week and they got in trouble. Mm-hmm. So my point to you is I don't want to hear any electronic device. Otherwise, you make a contribution to the Common School Fund because it really disrupts the testimony.
And a big one too, right, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I will state at the outset, in case anyone is out there waiting to testify with bated breath on Senate Bill 381, I left my file at home. That's my bill. And so we're not going forward with that today. We're going to move that over to Tuesday. I went home for a speech and a presentation somewhere, and then I left it on the kitchen table. So there we go. We will hear that one on Tuesday. If there's anyone here who needs auditory assistance, we do have plug-in ability speakers, and we have also printed some agendas, I think, in larger type if you have difficulty reading in the smaller type, which, unless I have my glasses, that's probably true for me. We are going to first go into an informational hearing on the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and the Oregon Community College Association. So we're going to hear from Cam Price-Brawley and Andrea Henderson, and I'll call that informational meeting into order and welcome you both up on this fine, foggy Oregon morning. Good morning. I don't care who starts. Maybe Ms. Brawley could go first.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Cam Price Brawley. I'm the commissioner for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And Andrea Henderson and I are here this morning to give you an overview of community colleges. And in front of you, you now have this lovely teal. Matches my outfit. I did this just for
nationwide
TV.
Really?
You have to know.
Yeah. Wow.
That's impressive.
I think I match too.
Indeed. I'm going to go over some of the materials that are in the folder, not all of them, just because of time. But for those of you who don't know, the department is the administrative entity, if you will, for the 17 community colleges, 7 workforce investment areas, the administration of the GED, the administration of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and federal job training dollars in the state. And I probably need to apologize right up front that Senator Morris sat through Ways yesterday, where I covered an awful lot of the same information. So see if we can't keep him awake. Andrew will have to do that.
You have. Oh, well, I missed that exciting testimony yesterday because I was in district, so
yes.
I think I'll stay awake. Thank you.
On the right-hand side of the packet that I handed out is a brief overview of the department, and it lists our mission. As I said, we are the administrative entity for about $600 million a biennium, and if you add capital construction, it exceeds $800,000. What we deliver, none of those programs ourselves except the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, which I'm aware that the chair is an advisory committee member of.
A past advisory committee member,
yes.
But thank you. Yeah, it's an excellent organization.
So our function tends to be primarily financial, administrative, audit, data collection, reporting. We approve with the State Board of Education all programs that are offered at the community college, and the monitoring of the federal job training programs. Just to give you a sense of the scope of the work, the middle paragraph on the overview lists that nearly 16,000 college students transferred to the university system last year, and over 88% of the people who enter the workforce programs actually enter employment. That's a little better than the national average. 50% of the students who enter adult basic education programs also are successful in reaching their goal and transferring into post-secondary education. Again, that's a little better than the national average. In 2003, the governor authored an executive order that created an employer workforce training fund, and that training fund uses federal workforce dollars, but instead of it going to people who are unemployed or underemployed, it goes to the training, goes to businesses so that they can train workers that are currently in their business, but to ensure that they have the appropriate and adequate skill. And over the last 3 years, better than 23,000 workers, that would be people who are incumbent on the job, have received critical knowledge-based training. And again, that's a program we don't deliver, but we do administer it and provide the evaluation and analysis of if those dollars are being spent in an appropriate and effective way. I think it's also important to note that on the left-hand side of the portfolio is a picture that looks something like this. We are a department of less than 50 employees, but we have interaction with three different boards on a regular basis, and that the first is the State Board of Education, which is the board that I work for, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is a public-private partnership board that directs the federal job training dollars, and then the joint boards, which is the Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education, and their work in alignment so that students who enter or leave high school or students in the community colleges who enter or leave have a seamless transition. And we've been working quite hard during the interim on making sure that any barriers that exist for students are removed.
Ms. Price-Bolley, could I ask you, are all these boards meeting together on a pretty regular basis now to make sure they're all sort of tracking in the same direction?
Madam Chair, I actually remember a similar question last session, and I'm happy to report that, yes, they are.
Good.
The Workforce Board meets quarterly. The Joint Boards is in statute to meet three times a biennium, and I think they are on schedule, if not ahead of schedule. And the State Board, I think in statute, is to meet nine times a year, and they meet every month except November and July. So they meet together. So as you say, the Workforce Board now joins the joint boards, not necessarily as a voting member, but certainly a voice, business voice that's recognized and heard in the conversation and debate.
And those meetings are all noticed and open to the public, are they not?
Madam Chair, yes, indeed they are.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Just very quickly, I'm going to go through, because this is a briefing to the Education Committee, so I'm going to spend a few minutes going over this handout, which is a picture of where community colleges are. The page one really gives you a snapshot of where we are with enrollments. The headcount is up a little from our low point of 330,000, but it's not to our high point of 400,000 in 2001-02. We still suffer from the loss of state investment and the spiraling up of tuition during that same time period, and we calculate that nearly 49,000 students still haven't come back to the community college. On the inside of that briefing, is a snapshot of funding. First you have the enrollment, then you have funding, and it, those bar graphs give you a pretty good visual of the state support for community colleges. The second graph is a picture of what was requested, that hash mark bar, the request of the agency to the governor was for support per student at $2,900, a little over, and the governor's recommended budget came in at $2,700. Certainly we're appreciative of the $400 per student, but it, in our calculations, does not yet provide adequate funding for each student that is served. Moving over to page three, what does the enrollment and funding mean to students? And we have a picture there in the middle of the page of that contrasts state support and tuition. And you will note that tuition was up until 99-01 and even 01-03, it was pretty moderate, but it has taken a rather large step up, again, as I said, to make up for the loss of state investment. And the last picture on page three, the last graph, bar graph, shows you the number of courses that are contained inside programs inside every institution across the state. And you'll notice the rapid decline as funding was being reduced, class sections were also reduced.
It looks like a nosedive. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
yes,
I would point out that that the funding increases over the last couple biennia and also in this governor's budget don't even really get community colleges back to the level they were before we chopped the heck out of them during special sessions. So I think that's a critical element that our Ways and Means folks need to be aware of.
And I think Senator Morse and I clearly understand that, and I appreciate you pointing that out because you're exactly right.
On the back page, then, is the capital construction. It's one thing to have an investment in your operating budget, but you also need capacity. You need space for those students. So the governor's budget has $87 million of Article 11G bonds for matching local dollars that the colleges raise. Pardon me. And for those of you who may be new to this, the department and the colleges and the association run through a very rigorous process to review and rank the colleges and their projects. We prepared a ranked order of that the governor, which was of $108 million, of that the governor proposed $87 million, and that includes 12 of Oregon's 17 colleges. And if you're interested in how we did that ranking, it's described there on the page. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Do we have any idea when the bonds authorized during the last legislature who were put in abeyance because of potential ballot measure impacts are going to be authorized?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, probably early April.
Okay. Thank you.
That's an excellent question. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Ms. Henderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I was asked today to talk about our work in the interim and our legislative agenda for this session. So I'm very delighted to cover those two topics and would like to spend some time talking about our work in the interim because I think it's very important for the community colleges, and I'd like you to know what progress that we have made. I have a handout that has some slides on here, and the first slide talks about our community college governance, and we are often asked what's the difference between Cam and myself, and Cam is the commissioner for the state agency. We also have an association for the community colleges, Each community college is locally governed by a locally elected board. And that's one of the strengths of the community colleges, that local connection allows the community colleges to make decisions locally that best impact their local community. And the 17 colleges collectively belong to the association. And the association is governed by a board of one board member from each college and the president of each college. And the board members always hold the leadership positions in my association. My president and vice president are locally elected board members. And the association's goal is to be a voice for those 17 local boards and colleges. We provide many services to the colleges in addition to advocacy. We provide board member training and opportunities for board members to grow as board members, both in how to be good board members, but also in terms of issues to help them make wise decisions on the local level. I wanted to just talk about governance first because I think that's a really critical issue for community colleges. And our major work in this last interim was to work on a strategic planning process for the 17 community colleges. And this is critical because this is something new. It is not something that the 17 colleges collectively have undertaken in the past. While we've had terrific collaboration amongst the various colleges around specific issues, it marks the first time that the colleges collectively have got together and talked about that while they are 17 locally governed colleges, it is important given the needs of the state and the needs of their students to talk together more collectively about what are those areas that can be best accomplished through collective work, not just 17 individual colleges. And so spent a lot of time in the interim to talk about what those areas are and what is the strategic vision of the 17 colleges collectively. So I wanted to talk with you a little bit about that today. In preparing the work for the strategic plan, there was a couple of key elements that the colleges were very aware of. And I have a couple of charts in here that I think help explain it. Critical to that was the understanding that our economic success really is going to depend on the education of Oregonians, and that it is so critical to Oregon's future that conversations about how can we do that even better. We believe we're doing a good job now, but that's not good enough. And how do we increase that for the future? Key amongst that was the fact that the majority of jobs in the future are high-skill jobs that require more than a high school education. It's a dramatic change nationwide from where we used to be, and we have not caught up to that yet. In 1950, only 20% of the jobs were skilled. In 2000, 65% of them are skilled. And we must do a better job of reaching out and making sure that we have skilled workers in our economy. Another very startling statistic for us was in Oregon, we're one of 13 states where the education level of our younger generation is actually less than our older generation. And that really is a sign that perhaps we're going in the wrong direction to have the educated workforce that we need. And so, again, that was it's a very alarming statistic. And I do have some charts.
I'm going to stop you for a second because that is an alarming statistic, especially given that access has been expanded over the number of years. Of course, the cost has gone up, but that surprises me. Why is that? Do you have some speculative idea about that?
Madam Chair, I believe it's there's not just one reason for it, but several different reasons. We are one of 13 states where we have that distinction. That's not a good distinction. We have lost access, particularly in community colleges, over the last 5 years. And we do have some trends in Oregon where we import an educated workforce rather than training our own. And that is a trend that we must really reach out to the workforce that's in Oregon right now that has less skills than needed to have a good job. There are many Oregonians out there that fall in that category, and we need to get them into community colleges and higher education so that they can get the necessary skills.
Thank you.
So as we look at all of these issues, the colleges collectively came together to start the process of a strategic plan, and actually adopted five key goals in December of our strategic plan, which are listed in your packet. The five goals are not in rank order, but are interrelated to each other. But one of the keys really is around access. And we set out a goal to increase access for an additional 100,000 students by the year 2020 in post-secondary education. We came up with that number by looking at a recommendation from the Education Commission on the States that put together a report on the participation gap in the United States and actually set a goal for each state. And according to that report, Oregon needs an additional 108,000 post-secondary students by the year 2015. We rounded it down to 100 and gave ourselves an extra 5 years to try to reach that goal. And it was a very deliberate choice by my board to use the term post-secondary students, not community college students, to recognize that we are part of an educational system. And it's community colleges, it's the university system, it's the independent colleges that all have a role in this. And what we can really call out is the leadership role of community colleges and what can we do both within community colleges and with communication and cooperation with other sectors to increase that. On our other goals, we have a goal to increase our quality and accountability for community colleges and are currently working on a very thorough examination of our current benchmarks. We think we're doing a good job. We think we can do better and are looking at that as well. Our third goal is around leadership. Our fourth goal is around ensuring that we have a structure in place to make good decisions on a statewide level. And then our fifth goal is around securing a public investment so that we can meet the other goals to increase the access for community colleges. That's the major work that the association did during the interim, which really lays the groundwork for our legislative agenda. The key component of our legislative agenda is to increase access for our community colleges, and we believe that there's three parts to access. Access is money into the support fund so that we can offer the programs. Access is a capital construction so we have the facilities to offer the programs. And access is money for financial aid so that students who cannot otherwise afford to go to community colleges have the resources to be able to go. So that is essentially our goals towards access. We think all three of those are interrelated and must be looked at in relation to each other, and not just one funded without the others, but they have to be funded in conjunction with each other so you're not out of alignment. So students, for example, don't have money, the financial aid to go to college, but not a program to go into, that all three of them have to work to increase our access. We have down on our agenda, we are asking for $529 million into the support fund to accomplish that. That is $46 million more than the governor's budget. We're very pleased with the governor's budget. It enables the bulk of our colleges to not be facing drastic cuts, and that is a change from the last couple of years. However, it's not an amount of money that allows us to increase the access for community colleges. And that, we believe, is really the key, is to look at how far can we go in this biennium to turn around some of those trends and increase the access. We are also seeking $108 million for capital construction for facilities and $105 million for financial aid for community colleges. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions either about our strategic planning process or our legislative agenda.
Senator Cruz has a question, but I want to clarify something first. Your request for capital construction is 108, mm-hmm. but I understand the governor's recommended budget is less than that from his colleague. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, yes, the governor's budget funded 12 of our 15 projects. As the commissioner noted, we had a ranked list of 15 projects that were submitted to the governor. The governor did not fund our number 4 project, our number 13 project, and our number 15 project, which were projects for Mount Hood Community College, Chemeketa Community College, and Klamath Community College. We, as an association, support the work that the colleges did to rank that, and we believe that any changes in that funding level should follow the ranked list. Particularly for Mount Hood Community College, which was ranked number 4 on our list, we would like to see that funded.
And was Chemeketa at 13 and Klamath at 15?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, that will be the work of the Ways and Means mm-hmm. Education Subcommittee to figure out if we agree with you or disagree with you, but I appreciate that you pointed that out. And the financial aid, I assume that that's coming along with the shared responsibility grant, and hopefully Congress will follow through and the President will sign a bill that reduces that interest rate on student loans, because we did have testimony here from the Student Association a week or so ago that one student was paying 14.25% on a Sallie Mae loan, which I thought was outrageous. I got a note from one of my colleagues here that said it was obscene, and when I spoke to President Dave Frohnmayer earlier this week, he said, is that one of our students? And so I said, I'm not sure. We found out it's a Portland State student. But that's obscene. That's what you'd get on a credit card for, just buying things, not student loans. So we really all got a sort of a slap in the face about that. So thank you. Senator Cruz, you have a question?
Yeah, just to Andrea, I guess I would... You did a glass half full thing. I'll do a glass half empty thing. When you were talking about the money in the governor's budget, where a lot of your colleges won't have to make cuts, but some of them still will. So that's the glass half mm-hmm. empty.
Okay. Any other questions down here? Okay. Well, thank you both. I appreciate the testimony this morning. It was enlightening, as usual. I'm glad to see you're all working together and trying to make this work. And I think, you know, the governor's really made it a priority this session, and that's a good thing. And Oregon is in a little bit better situation, and I hope we're a little bit smarter with some of the money, and maybe we can get ourselves a rainy day fund and really start working for Oregon. Okay. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go into the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. We sometimes forget about that organization and what they do. So Mr. Gary Andean is here with us as our executive director.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. My name, for the record, is Gary Andean. I'm executive director of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association, with offices up in Tigard. You're passing out some background charts and graphs that we'll go through as I read through my testimony. We always appreciate the opportunity at the start of a session to spend a few minutes updating you on the independent colleges in the state. It's a fairly large group of relatively small institutions that account for significant enrollment, degree production, economic impact, and civic betterment for the people of Oregon. I begin by thanking the legislature on behalf of these institutions, their staff, their students, their parents, their alumni, their trustees, their donors, their friends, and their neighborhoods, for the many and varied ways that the state of Oregon has partnered with these institutions over decades in a common cause to elevate the educational achievement of people in Oregon. At present in Oregon, on the first page of your handout, there are 33 private institutions authorized to grant degrees by the Oregon Office of Degree Authorization. Their combined fall headcount enrollment this past fall was about 38,000 students. This represents about 18% of the total post-secondary enrollment in Oregon and generates 25% of the total post-secondary degrees awarded in the state. 30% of Oregon's combined baccalaureate and graduate enrollment is at these institutions, and at the graduate and baccalaureate level, they award 33% of the degrees. Among the 33 institutions, we see a great deal of diversity in size, in program, in ethos, in selectivity, and in price. Some are for-profit, but most are non-profit. Some are two-year programs, but most are four-year and graduate programs. Some offer only religious degrees and don't qualify for state student aid. Some offer only graduate degrees and don't qualify for state student aid in Oregon. Some are based out of state and don't qualify for state student aid. Mm-hmm. Among the 33, there are 19 that are Oregon-based, nonprofit, and regionally accredited. Those 19 are the ones that pay my salary and that make up the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. They enroll about 28,000 of the students, 19,000 undergrads, and 9,000 grads. Those 28,000 students will deposit more than $1 billion into the Oregon economy this year for expenses related to their college education. More than half of the OIC of my students, about 15,500, are Oregonians, and the profile of those Oregonians is nearly identical to the profile of Oregonians attending Oregon University System institutions in gender, in minorities percentages, in age, and in family income. Average retention rates at the independent institutions are more than 80% from freshman to sophomore year. Graduation rates are 54% in 4 years and 64% in 6 years. In spite of these and many other impressive statistics, Oregon's independent colleges and universities garner less than 1% of the state's higher education budget. And all of that strictly in the form of student aid to low-income undergraduate Oregonians. The 2007 legislative agenda for OICA institutions is all about partnering with public institutions and state government to improve the ability of all Oregonians to make post-secondary education choices that are accessible, affordable, and appropriate for their skills and ambitions. Last fall, across all the OICA institutions, we saw a slight increase in new undergraduates from out of state, about 2%. We saw a large 21% increase in new undergraduates from community colleges. But we saw our first ever decrease, 4%, in new undergraduates from Oregon high schools. That mirrors OUS experience and is especially alarming since Oregon already scores low in national comparisons of its college-going rate. I believe that's about the fifth item in your packet, chance for college. Consequently, during the 2000 legislative session, OICA institutions will be supportive and will want to participate in four areas of legislation. First, increasing the size and distribution of opportunity grants and reshaping their calculation around the shared responsibility model. Secondly, enlarging the proven Aspire program, bringing thousands of new volunteers, college access mentors, I call them, to all of Oregon's high schools. Third, extending the state tax deduction for 529 college savings plans from $2,000 per tax filing to $3,000 for single filers and $6,000 for joint filers. It will still be much less than many, many states offer in deductions. And fourth, providing state funding for a $100 529 savings starter kit for every newborn baby in Oregon.
Oh, would you repeat that?
We're introducing legislation that would ask you to fund a $100 starter kit of a 529 savings plan for every newborn baby in Oregon.
You've introduced that bill this session?
Yes. Send the message that we consider everybody in Oregon to be college material, or at least post-secondary education material, and we want everybody in the state to treat their children from birth onward that way. And we're hoping that will get a lot of interest during the session. I don't think we have a bill number yet. It's coming out of LC right now. But I will obviously see that you get it.
That's really fascinating. So is this would be $100 that every parent would hopefully pitch in. And, you know, I have to tell you, though, when my children were born, we were poor as church mice. We had just graduated college, and we were paying $50 a month rent for a little sweet little cabin on the McKenzie River. But we had no money, and $100 was a lot of money. But you're saying it would be a tax credit.
It would be, this would be, we'll have to work that out during the session,
yeah,
how we actually structure it, whether it's a chit or a voucher or an actual, you're handed a 529 plan that's already been created with $100 in it, or whether you have to do it, whether you have to match the $100 before it actually kicks in, all kinds of details. But we really think that this is an opportunity for us to send a long-term message that people need to be thinking about our children as college material, every one of them, not just the ones who are going to start 529 plans on their own,
right,
but everybody.
Well, I think it's a fascinating idea. I look forward to seeing the bill come out.
There's roughly 50,000 newborns in the state each year, so this could cost $5 million a year. In the larger context, that might not be a lot of money, given the kind of private investment that that should leverage over the next 20 years for all those newborn babies headed for college. So we'll see. More generally, our legislative agenda includes attention to opportunities for partnering with state and local government and with our sister public institutions in developing and sustaining a rich blend of high-quality academic programs and helping students more easily transition from high school to college and from college to college, in leveraging more private investment in all of our public and private sector students and institutions, and finally in enhancing the affordability of higher education in both sectors, public and private, to all low and middle income Oregonians. Again, thank you for inviting the independent higher education community to the table and for recognizing that we all share a common mission to improve the quality of life and the prosperity of every Oregonian now and into the future. I'd be happy to answer any questions now and look forward to working with you throughout the session.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the committee? No. I was looking at your fact book on the chance for college by age 19.
Yes.
2004. It looks like Oregon's graduation rates were 28th in the nation. That's 72%, if I'm reading that correctly.
Correct.
New Jersey's at 85.6. But at least we're doing better than Washington and California. We always get compared to Washington State, and we're doing a little bit better. But I'd like to know what the states at the top are doing to get those graduation rates.
I think those are good questions. It'd be fun to quiz those states about how that happens.
Yeah, and I've not seen this sort of a chart before, so I'm going to take this, Senator Morse, I'm taking this down to our Education Ways and Means Subcommittee, and I'm going to be asking questions about that. And you have a question.
Well, and not a question, but thank you for appearing, Gary. You have provided data that I have not seen before.
Ah.
And it's very illuminating. And just having been involved in a recruitment for a highly skilled orthopedic surgeon to our community and extolling the virtues of Oregon, this is not the information that would be helpful in that activity. Thank you. It's something that we need to take very seriously. Thank you.
Yeah, and this was easy for me to read because it has colors. That I'm a visual sort of learner, so I appreciate that you've done that. Sometimes I get lost in charts and the little arrows and such. I really appreciate that.
Next time we'll go for teal, since that's what Cam wore today.
That's what Cam wore today. Yeah, this pink on the front, well, that's sort of baby pink. But, you know, that goes along with that bill you're introducing, and I do want you to come by and talk to me about that when you get it out of legislative council, that there's a little bit of a...
We're looking forward to taking that around and talking to people about it.
Yeah.
Inviting other people to think about why this would be important and how we might pitch it to everyone. There is obviously a serious question about what you do with people who can't afford to be making tax deductible contributions to their 529 plans. I think just sending the message that we want everybody to think that way about their children will make just a huge difference in grade school and high school and college. I really look forward to lobbying that particular bill.
Yeah, have you had that conversation with the state treasurer about the bill?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yes. Yeah, in fact, Randall Edwards, our state treasurer, was in the legislature and helped create the college savings fund plan when we were served together in the House. And he was in here the other day testifying about how much money's in it.
Right.
And it's been a tremendous
It took off very well in our state, Madam Chair.
And, yeah, and your idea is real creative, and I love creative thinking, so thank you. Senator Kurtz, did you have any questions?
No, I'm interested in that as well, having stepchildren that are vested in the Florida program, and which is very good. My six-year-old, by the time she starts second grade, will be fully vested, and it's real comfort, so... but they've been a bit, yeah. So we may need to look at seeing if other folks are doing things, maybe in a slightly more aggressive way than we are. So, and I'm a Willamette grad, so go Bearcats.
Madam Chair, if you look at the last sheet in the handout that
uh-huh.
I gave, the borrowing rates for the debt loads of our 4-year students when they graduate. I think it's a little remarkable that the debt loads are about the same in both the public and the private sector for four-year students coming out, and the number of students, about 67% and 70% of students with debt. These are the kinds of things that could go away if families had been investing in college savings for 15 or 20 years.
So. Now, I feel really bad about that. I didn't do that very well with my children, but so now they both have debt, and they're in master's programs, which, oh my, it's like buying a new car when you go into a master's program. The cost of those, holy cow.
I've got children doing the same thing. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. All right, well, Mr. Andean, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Okay, we'll close the informational hearings that we had scheduled for today. I think we only have one more of those. We're going to hear from the Department of State Lands, get an update on the Common School Fund.
Cool.
Since Senator Cruz and I are so excited about that. So now we're going to move into some bill matters. So I will gavel in a public hearing on SCR 3. And Senator Morse, I didn't realize it, but I wore my reversible jacket today, and I've never worn it on the other side, but given that you're going to be talking about beavers, I'll turn it around.
That's really good pre-planning.
I know. I did. I have to tell you, I did go to a beaver game one time and wore what I thought was orange, and Senator Westland chided me and said, "That's not orange, that's pink." So I hope I qualify. Oh,
that's close.
Orange. All right. Thank you. And you're joined by Representative Wisnett. I'm happy to see you here.
Chair.
Take it away, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I keep forgetting. Ms. Richardson has a wonderful likes to introduce our bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 would commend the Oregon State University baseball team for winning the NCAA Division I national title.
Oh, cool.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morse, State Senator representing the Albany-Corvallis area. And Oregon State University is a prominent feature in my district, and I'm proud to represent them. I won't go into the language, specific language of the resolution, but what this is an opportunity for the body, legislative body, to give appropriate recognition for something that Oregon State had never done, and in fact had never been accomplished by any Northwest school, and that is to win a national baseball championship. It was done in dramatic fashion. The team captured the hearts of not just Oregonians, but all of the Northwest and all of the nation in the way that they came from behind and stayed in the tournament in Omaha and eventually won. This is a tribute not just to the school, it's a tribute to the players and to the coaches and the staff for what they accomplished and the way that they accomplished it. I've been most proud of the baseball team and the character that they display. I happen to have season tickets, was not able to attend all of the games, but of the games that I was able to see with my wife, it was a pleasure to watch young men display sportsmanship and character in a way that you don't often see in many sports. And what Oregon State accomplished was unparalleled, and it's appropriate that we recognize, I think, in this body, that accomplishment. Now, you'll notice on the sponsorship of the bill, you'll see 12 legislators. Those legislators are all graduates of Oregon State University. We are hoping that we will have the opportunity to present this in person to the team at their first home game, which will occur hopefully in March. There are some scheduling issues with respect to whether the field improvements will be done, but our hope is that we can personally represent this body on the field at Oregon State and present this resolution. Now, my colleague here has some statements to make. Representative Wisnett is a graduate of the University of North Carolina.
I was wondering why he's here. You are not on this list.
And we need to be accurate in this resolution, and that what is what brings Representative Wisnett to the table this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really am honored that Senator Morris suggested I come and support this amendment. First, let me thank you for the opportunity to speak on this resolution commending the 2006 NCAA Division I Baseball Championship Oregon State University Beaver baseball team for an outstanding season. I'm a big baseball fan, and I was watching every game. I recommend approval of this deserving resolution, but there is a slight amendment we need to consider. As the senator said, I'm a graduate of the University of North Carolina. I bleed Carolina blue. This was a tough series for me because I do have allegiance to Oregon State University, where my wife attended school, her father graduated, and I'm honored to have a branch campus of the Oregon State University in my county. But I'm sure that all Beaver fans would appreciate having the record of their great championship season corrected. In the original resolution, OSU Beaver baseball team did not sweep the University of North Carolina Tar Heels in two games. I'm sure it was an administrative error. As the senator said, it was a great series in Oregon State, and I think the University of North Carolina Tar Heels demonstrated a great spirit, great baseball performance. They think at the end of the game they were all, you know, saluting each other because they had a couple of games that they'd all had to come back from behind. And actually, in the championship series in Omaha, Nebraska, the College World Series, North Carolina Tar Heels, the higher-ranked team. But in Game 1, the Tar Heels defeated the Beavers pretty strongly. In Game 2, the Tar Heels were up again, and the coach left the pitcher in too long. But the Beavers came back and won a great game, evening the series at 1-1. And the third game, the Tar Heels were on the roll again, and the UNC coach, at the end of the game, towards the end of the game, put the catcher at first base, who had never played first base, who missed a catchable throw to let the Beavers come back in another rally to secure the victory in the championship. So with the record corrected, chair and committee members, I think it's properly to honor this great Beaver team, coach, and fans.
And with that, Madam Chair, colleagues, we ask for your approval of this resolution to move it to the floor and hopefully suspend rules, second reading, and move it to a third reading so we can appropriately honor that opening game.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate that you both come here a little bit tongue-in-cheek, Representative Wisnett, but, you know, I'm a duck, and Jock Mills knows that, and it's taken a lot for me to wear this orange right now, but I'm also a Tar Heel because my father's family is from Waynesville, North Carolina, and I have lots of family back in North Carolina, so I have an allegiance to that university as well, and I appreciate that you've set the record straight, and I appreciate this resolution because it is a tremendous honor for the state of Oregon for a team of character and integrity and strength and the ability to do what they've done to bring this award home to Oregon. So thank you, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, to set the record further straight, because I am a Pac-10 fan first and foremost, obviously, but besides that, I'm a Duke Blue Devil fan. So, so Gene, just so you'll know. And I appreciate Representative Wisnett and his comments, but to set the record straight, coaching decisions were made, but I would ascertain, Madam Chair, that the Beaver baseball team, and actually the fact they lost the first game in that championship series, I mean, they were a comeback team all the way through this thing, and they just beat them. That's it. So it's not a matter of coaching decisions. The best team won. That's it. So just for the record, Madam
it's a
Chair.
Little bit like Seabiscuit, and I really relate to Seabiscuit after this last stretch. Senator Metzger, well, did you want to make a comment?
Well, the only comment I think there we... Representative Wisnett left out three words on the dash one. I think it's after the and. It should say, and whoop them good. But other than that,
the good loser.
All right. Well, thank you both.
Chair.
I really appreciate that. We do, I think there's probably some agreement up here, and if my vice chair would be interested in making a motion, we have a -1 amendment here, and I don't see that we have anyone else here for public testimony, so we're going to gavel out of that, and we're going to gavel into a work session, and you should have that -1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to SCR3.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to SCR3. Any discussion? I don't think we'll entertain your further amendment, Senator Metzger.
But it would have been a good one.
It would have been a good one.
We want to expedite the process.
All right. Well, hearing no objection to that, that will be approved. And so,
Madam Chair, I move SCR3 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
With a due dispatch.
Yes.
All right. Senator Cruz moves SCR3 as amended to the floor of the Senate as quickly as we can get that done with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, we'll have the clerk call the roll on this one. And I'm sorry that Senator Whistlin is out sick today because he's a huge baseball fan, and I know he would have appreciated hearing this testimony. But go ahead.
Senator Dexter? Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Okay, SCR3 as amended has been approved. I'm going to ask you to carry it, Senator Morris, if you would please. And thank you very much for the opportunity to do this.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We'll close the work session on that bill and move right along. And I'll make a jacket change here in a moment, Jock. Okay, so we will move up to Senate Bill 261. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 261, and Ms. Richardson will talk to us about what that bill does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 261 requires publishers to provide instructional materials in alternative formats when requested by a post-secondary institution for use by students with disabilities, specifically for educational purposes. It defines terms related to instructional materials in alternative formats.
Okay, thank you. We have quite a few folks to testify today. And I want to remind you that if you need auditory assistance, we do have plug-in headsets for you. Let's see, I've got some proponents of the bill, and I think that would be Mr. Junedef and Ted Wink. So if you could both come forward, please, with the Oregon Advocacy Center.
Very accommodating.
Still look like raspberry please.
That's as orange as I'm going to get. I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Introduce yourselves, please.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedef, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. And with me today...
I'm Ted Wink. I'm a staff attorney at the Oregon Advocacy Center.
Great. Thank you. Who's going to go first?
I'll just start off, and the reason I'm here is just for those of you who aren't familiar with the Advocacy Center is just to introduce us to let you know that we are Oregon's protection and advocacy system. We're designated by the governor to play that role, and in that role we receive federal funding in order to advocate for individuals with disabilities across the state of Oregon. I've just provided you with a introduction to the Advocacy Center for those of you who aren't familiar with us. Just to answer the question that might be in your mind is, why are we here? And what I would encapsulate that, or I would summarize it by just saying that our goal for our clients who are Oregonians with disabilities is to assure their full participation in life of Oregon. And as I was listening to testimony about the beavers, I was taken by the fact that our role is really to make sure that students with disabilities have an opportunity to have the same experiences as other students, and that means to be beaver fans and to participate in all the opportunities that life affords us that including higher education to the degree that people can compete in that environment. And what the purpose of this bill really is to allow people who have certain types of disabilities to be able to engage in higher education, to compete on an equal playing field, and to succeed in life so that they can be successful and active members of our society. Today, our staff attorney, Ted Wenk, is here to take you through the bill and explain exactly what it does.
All right. Great. Thank you. Mr. Wenk.
Thank you. More specifically, the bill will allow post-secondary students with vision and specific types of learning disabilities to obtain course-assigned textbooks in a format which they can access and use. A student who is prevented by a disability from reading a printed book will be able to have an electronic version of the book, and then text reading software may provide the full benefit of the book to the student. The bill will require textbook publishers to supply an electronic version of a course textbook to a state post-secondary institution upon request from that institution's disability services office when it's on behalf of a student enrolled in a course and the textbook is required reading for that course. The textbook must be purchased and the copyright would be protected. Right now, state colleges and universities are required under the Americans with Disabilities Act and 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, federal act, to provide the students with disabilities accommodations for core components of course curriculum. This includes textbooks. A burden is put upon the staff time and resources of these disability services office in that they right now must manually scan a textbook and then format them for the students. And despite their great efforts in that, they are often unable to do so in a timely manner. Students end up having to drop courses, retake them, extend their stay in college involuntarily, and it places a financial burden upon the student. I first became aware of this issue when I had a student, call into our office and was not receiving his textbooks timely. He liked the people at the Disability Service Office at his university and was trying to work with them, but he just wasn't getting his books and was frustrated. So I sent an attorney letter off to the university, and we had a meeting with the state attorney and the representative from the university, and we talked about some things we could do to move this along. And finally, the disability service officer said to me, "Well, why? This would be if we had the legislation like they do in California and some other states. This would really help solve this issue." Now we came to address a number of accessibility issues in that meeting for that university, but I looked into it and said, "Well, I'm not sure why we don't." Textbook publishers normally already have the electronic version of the textbook, and they're in the best place to convert that into a format and provide it to the universities. They are not currently required to do so under the ADA, which was passed back in 1990. A number of other states have passed this, and since states have begun passing such legislation, the Textbook Publishers Association has taken some efforts to try and address this. And I think that this legislation will not only help motivate the publishers to continue in their efforts as more states see this as an issue, but it will also allow the students to get their textbooks today rather than waiting for a solution. They can get their textbooks now when this is passed.
Thank you. And we do have a representative of the Association of American Publishers here to testify today, so we'll hear their side of the story in a little bit. Any questions from the committee? Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing this forward. I guess my first one is that do we have any quantitative data on how big of a problem this is? For people who move through to post-secondary education, and suddenly have hit roadblocks like this that they haven't had heretofore? I mean, have we in a way put any size of issues around this, in which publishers have refused to do this, and we can document how big of an issue this is that would require a change in state law?
Well, we do have an individual here who will address at least how this has impacted at Portland State University when we brought this before the House Education when we brought this last session, and we were able to get a number of the disability services representatives, officers to attend with a short notice. At the beginning of the semester, we were unable to get them. We can get that data for you. We were just unable to get it from them and get them here at the short notice at the beginning of the semester. But he will be talking about some of those numbers.
Okay. I have one more follow up, mm-hmm. Manager. And then the other question would be. I know it's been a few years since I was in college, so I can realize that things may have changed a little bit. But thank you very much, Madam Chair. But one of the things that I found normal in my collegiate work was that the professor of the class pretty well dictated the materials and often required you to buy their books that they wrote. I kind of also wonder, too, is that in terms of trying to solve this problem, is the responsibility of the course instructor, you know, to require materials that are available in other formats as opposed to, someone who may be, ordering or requiring, reading of particular works of their own that create this problem in the first place, as opposed to having a standard of having required reading in which these materials are available in electronic format for people with disabilities. I mean, I just kind of wonder where the real responsibility is since unless that system has changed, in which the professor pretty well can control. If you want, if you want textbooks used in my class, they have to be available in electronic format, or I'll require something else. I mean, that's just in terms of looking to who's to make sure that the students have access to it. I think the professor has a lot of control in that.
Well, if the textbook is published, one thing this will do, as opposed to a voluntary system of publishers, right. It will require all publishers to comply.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you,
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger. Mm-hmm. Right now, there is an obligation under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act, two federal laws, for the school to provide these materials in alternative formats. One of the problems becomes is the cost and just the practicality of getting that done. If there's and there are some copyright issues as well. So there may be a textbook that a student needs to be made accessible. The school may be in a position of having to go through and Xerox an entire textbook, or scan it in order to produce it into electronic format. And this raises not only some issues that Jim Gardner might discuss in terms of copyright issues, but also its enormous cost to the university. Just as a practical matter, the cost and efficiency of having the textbook manufacturer make these volumes available in electronic format, which they almost invariably have in electronic format already, just kills two birds with one stone. It relieves the university of the cost and inconvenience and legal potential problems of reproducing it, and also just makes it available immediately to that student. So we think it's a win-win situation, and it's just a matter of getting it implemented nationally. And I think, as you'll hear, there's efforts to do that. We're just having problems getting there.
I was just approached by Mr. I believe it's Holm. He's the Disability Services Officer with Western Oregon University, and apparently he didn't notice the sign-in there, and he would like to address the numbers question, or he can...
Okay, sir, you just want to come on up. That would be fine. You can stay there, Mr. June Duff, if you wish.
No, we have a microphone here.
Okay, well, you can do the musical chairs, but you can at least stay up front. And, sir, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Philip Pinnell, and I'm the Director of Disability Services at Western Oregon University.
Okay.
And I thought I might be able to answer some of the university questions that are coming up, so if you could repose your question, I might be able to assist you.
Madam Chair, my question was, I'm trying to get a grasp of how broad this problem is, in which textbooks are assigned, in which there are folks with disabilities who don't have access to it, just you know, how broad a scope this is.
Okay. Well, Western Oregon University is a small school with about 5,000 students, and we've reproduced probably 80 textbooks for the entire year. A larger school would produce maybe over a couple hundred textbooks. The problem with textbooks is that they come in, the print versions have to be handled. The scanning part can be done relatively quickly, but it has to be re-edited in order to be reproduced. This takes a lot of time. Now, the problem is pretty widespread. Students with learning disabilities are probably the biggest consumers these days because they're better diagnosed. Normal people are go through our educational system. They're taught to learn visually. Not everybody's a visual learner. The auditory format is necessary. So the process of scanning the text, re-editing the text, and then putting it into an auditory format takes a while. So this can affect a student's ability to choose the class coursework based on the textbook itself. The change in the textbook usually comes from the manufacturer side. The publisher, not the instructor, especially at Western, chooses to put out a new edition. This, of course, costs the student more money because the new edition, the old edition, isn't viable anymore. The instructor doesn't have a lot of choices. They want to use this kind of text, so they choose the edition that is offered by the publisher. So, I actually was talking to the provost just the other day about textbooks, and I related the idea that instructors want their own textbook used. And at Western, this is not the case. We're not a Research One institution. We're not putting out a lot of publications of our own. It is definitely first edition that's coming out, or new edition coming out. So the problem in the United States, because I not only worked at Western, I'm a West Virginian by native, and worked in Las Vegas for 7 years, we have had very little success in getting publishers to provide us with an electronic copy in any format. If you did get it, the formats may not be constructed. I haven't been able to read the bill, so I'm not sure how it addresses the idea of formatting. There's some federal push for publishers, but at this time, I'm not aware of where they're getting with that idea. Does that answer your question?
That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, great. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I'm just curious as to definitions here, I suppose. For example, somebody who is dyslexic has problems reading. I mean, would they be included in this, and would this material be available to them? I'm just trying to get a sense of the scope of the universe we're talking about here.
That's in the definition of specific learning disability. Dyslexia is a very specific form of learning problem.
Right.
And yes, that, in my view, all students with learning disorders that would require an alternative format would be included as using this kind of material. Because they can't access the actual print. And even if they could, the amount of time necessary to read it would be extraordinary.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could direct our attention to page 3 of the bill, line 6, 7, and 8, in which it reads, in addition to the requirements of subsection 4 of this section, a publisher shall provide instructional material in an electronic format that is mutually agreed upon by the publisher and the post-secondary education institution. My question is, would we wind up with a host of institutions that each have different requirements? And if we're going to go down this road, it would seem to me that we should have a standardized approach so that it is not to the discretion of each institution.
And that's an excellent question.
Publisher format that they're talking
we're going to hear the answer to, and I think Mr. Gardner's going to raise that when he testifies. Well, I see him nodding in the back. So you get the first jump at this.
Publishers format in many different ways, using different electronic formatting to make their, the old days of the whole ditto, you know, processing of books is over. You know, they use the electronic formats, but they can be in multiple kinds of format, and they choose which one they're going to do based on their particular printing needs. So if they had to provide an electronic copy, do they get to choose? The bill is kind of saying we want the university to say and which format to read. Some screen readers will read different formats differently. So the idea of unifying that or demanding of the publisher you switch your format, I think, is what they're getting into. It would require a more standardization of format in order to process at the university level. That's why the university would need to know what it is coming. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I understand the issue that you're bringing forth, and one of the reasons that the bill is drafted this way has been the ongoing changing of technology in this area, and with the recognition that nationally most secondary institutions are going to use similar formats, which are going to be traditionally ASCII format or WordPerfect or Adobe. We would be open to discussing creating a specific format within this bill so that there was clearer direction, although our expectation would be that even as the bill is written, that because of the limited alternatives that are available to students in universities under present technology, that we would arrive at those would pretty much be consistent as a general matter. Theoretically, I suppose in the future there may be a new type of software or technology that might alter that, and we'd like to be able to move with the times, which is why we wrote it in this more flexible manner. But if the committee would be more comfortable with a more specific format, we'd certainly be open to that.
Senator?
You follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. It would seem to me that if we do this, that Oregon institutions should represent one request and not have one institution make a request in a format that's different from another institution.
Okay, I think I'd like to, we're going to hear from Mr. Gardner, and I'd like to hear his perspective about that, but you raise a really valid point, and I think it's something that we can work on after we hear from the other side what their opinion is about this.
Madam Chair, if I may
make
one last comment, is that, and I think that Mr. Gardner would agree with this, is that our goal, our mutual goal, is to make sure that students with disabilities can participate in higher education. We want to move that forward, and we certainly want to make sure that the bill does that. And if there is anything in the bill that interferes with that goal, we certainly want to address it.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. I would just like to let the committee know that I'm a court reporter, and one of my business associates is she works in the schools, and she goes into the classroom with some of these college students who are visually impaired, and she takes down the notes from the class, and that's one way that we get their services. But it's very expensive to do, so I don't think she has as much work available as she used to, but I know she was shadowing one student at Oregon State for quite a while and one at the University of Oregon. But we do try to accommodate, but it gets very expensive, and how do you do it? And I think Senator Morse has raised a good question to make it happen, but make it happen in a way that's cost-effective. Okay, I've got some other folks I want to hear from, so thank you, gentlemen, very much. We have three other proponents, so I'm going to ask you to come up, and then we'll hear from Mr. Gardner when you're all done. Brett Rowlett with the Oregon Student Association, Kevin O'Reilly with Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, and David Chittenden. I hope I did that correctly. So if I can get all three of you at once, that would be great. I have four. Okay. Okay, I just didn't want to miss any of you. So I'm going to start from my left and go to my right. Brett, why don't you introduce yourself and talk about what the students think about this, and then we'll move down the aisle.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My name is Brett Rillette. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students at Oregon's colleges and universities, and today I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 261. By the end of this decade, 87% of new jobs created in Oregon will require some type of education beyond high school. Access to higher education has never been more important, both to students and to our state. Textbooks are a necessity for students at all levels, but even more so in higher education, where students are expected to do more learning outside of the classroom than in. Senate Bill 261 will guarantee that all students in our universities and community colleges have access to the textbooks necessary to complete their education. Over the past three decades, the number of students attending post-secondary education with disabilities has increased dramatically. According to the Health Resource Center, 2.6% of students attending post-secondary institutions in 1978 reported having some type of disability. Today, the numbers are much higher. 9.3% of incoming freshmen report having some type of disability, with 32% of those reporting visual or hearing impairments. The greatest challenge for students with visual impairments in today's world is the amount of printed materials that they face. Often, students are unable to use standard printed materials or read information written on blackboards or projectors in class. Many are unable to fully use audiovisual materials as well. While Oregon's colleges and universities have made great strides in assisting students with disabilities, they're only able to do so much. It's up to the publishers of textbooks and printed materials that students use at the universities to also help assist with this. Providing printed materials in large text and/or electronic versions would greatly assist thousands of Oregonian students. Senate Bill 261 will guarantee that students in Oregon's universities and community colleges with disabilities have the same opportunity for success in their classes as their peers do. It protects the textbook companies from undue burden while giving students with disabilities the access and opportunity that all students deserve. Today, this is more important than ever. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions, Mr. Rillette? All right. Our next in line here.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is David Chittenden. I am a master's student at Portland State University. I am here to speak in support of this bill. There were a lot of questions. I used to work as an assistive technology specialist and as an advocate for disability rights. So when I found out about this committee hearing 2 days ago, I went to the the DRC Disabled Resource Center and got some statistics. I also had them provide some samples for you of a scanned. You'll see that there's scanned text before it's been OCR'd, which is optical character recognition, and then you'll see the text after it's been OCR'd but before it has been edited, and you'll see that there are errors. No scanning software is 100% accurate. The scanning software which we are using at Portland State University has a rating, according to certain computer magazines, of 98.5% accuracy, and that's one of the highest rated, in fact, it is the highest rated software program for OCR currently. But you'll see 98.5% does not mean 98% of the words. It means 98% of the characters. So you'll see the errors that you see are in the, you know, there might be a letter or a couple letters that are misinterpreted. It also greatly varies based on font style, things like that. There's a lot of variation. So there's, I had them provide a normal scan, a hard scan, and finally, I had them provide a scan of a book that had a lot of highlighting in it. Since I have to go and purchase a book, if there are used books available, I am unable to purchase those used books. It is essential that I purchase a new book every time, because scanning highlighted text does not work very well. In fact, it can completely block out, in some cases, the text that is there. And it greatly increases the amount of time it takes for the book to be converted. The just as a course of numbers, just so that you kind of get an understanding, in 2005 summer quarter, there were 24 books that were scanned, and there were two accessible electronic books that were received from publishers. In fall of 2005, 78 books were scanned,
oh my gosh,
and 10 books were received from publishers. Now, that actually, unfortunately, is the highest number of books that were received from publishers. Winter of 2006, 97 books were scanned, and 2 books were received from publishers. In spring of 2006, it was 68 books scanned, and 0 books were received from publishers. In summer, it was 20 books and 1 received. And then in fall of 2006, 70 books were scanned, and I do not have the numbers for what was received. And in winter of 2007, so far, 64 books have been scanned. The with the whole scanning, it takes, according to the DRC, they have 9 scanners currently and 1 graduate assistant. It takes approximately, depending on the complexity of the book, it can take up to 3 months. They get the syllabus when they can and start providing the chapters, where you'll get the chapter a few days before class that chapter is due on the syllabus. This becomes a problem, especially becomes a problem, one, if you want to, you know, if you have some time and you want to read ahead. Two, if, and this happened to me last year, in spring quarter, I had a book that was required but did not appear on the syllabus. And it turned out the book was to be used for the final. I discovered this the week of the final. The publisher, or the DRC, had not scanned the book because there was no chapters listed in the syllabus. And I ended up getting the book back from the DRC, and I found someone who was willing to spend time assisting me at very short notice to follow the forms in that book to for my what was required for my finals. So it really gets complicated. In addition, when you have differing formats, whatever format, based on the comments that were made before, but if you choose a specific format and then things change, as we all know that they do, for example, the open document format controversy that has been going on in Massachusetts now is a completely different format. PDF formats are not very accessible. They're talking ASCII text. I personally prefer RTF. I find that is the most accessible to the most software programs that I have. So the formats, that's one issue that personally I think that it should remain open, because different universities will have different software that they can utilize, especially the smaller universities might not have the funds for if a different version of software is required, and the complexity to convert from that software to something which is accessible can really create as many problems as it solves. In addition, when I take my books in for scanning, because they do so many books, they take and chop the binding off my book. So one, I have to purchase a new book, and I cannot purchase a used book even when there are used books. Two, I cannot return my books to the bookstore for any partial refund of money, because my books have had the bindings removed, and at the end of the semester they then send the books out and get them rebound. So they are now unacceptable to any of the bookstores. So those are several of the issues. And one final thing, I actually quit school back in the 80s when I first was in college, because it was so complicated to get books. I would often receive books, back then I received them on tape, and I would often receive books or chapters of books by the end of the semester or after the end of the semester, and I just could not keep up, so I dropped out of school. Now at least I usually get at least the chapters that are listed in the syllabus. If I'm lucky, I'll get the entire book before semester starts, if I can get it like 1 or 2 months before the beginning of the semester. If I'm very lucky, and because I do that and most students don't, if I'm unlucky, I will get the book a couple days before the chapters are due, so I can sit down and read through the chapters before class starts.
Thank you, Mr. Chitten. And you have given us a lot of information I did not know before, and I appreciate that. And in the sense of time, I'd like to move along to the person seated next to you, which I assume will be Kevin O'Reilly.
This is true.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Kevin O'Reilly, and I am here representing the members of the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. With me this morning is Terry Brown. He's our chapter's vice president. We're going to use Terry Brown as a visual aid in a moment. We strongly support Senate Bill 261. A means of providing educational opportunities, which is long overdue. We believe Senate Bill 261 will be a big step forward in helping not only our members, but all students with significant mobility impairments while they pursue their educational goals. I have asked Terry to act as our demonstration model, and I'm going to ask Terry to open his book to page 281. We believe having textbooks in electronic format or e-text available to those students with limited hand function will assist them in keeping up with their coursework and reduce the costs associated with assistance many students incur while attending colleges and universities. We further believe that there will also be an accompanying savings to the universities, just in manpower and other costs associated with providing disabled students services in their education. We further believe that the cost associated with producing electronic textbooks will be no greater than that associated with printed materials, and perhaps even less, and that's towards the publishers. We are mindful of the potential for copyright infringement, but we believe that there are not only sufficient safeguards in place through an institution's Office of Disabled Student Services, but also software means that can greatly reduce the ability to pirate e-text. We are aware of multiple copyrights involved with some textbooks. We believe these issues can be addressed through contractual arrangements. We believe many, if not all, publishers have the ability to produce textbooks in alternative format. Terry, there's a reference there to page 157. Would you go back to page 157, please? We do provide... Why, I lost my place. Further, we understand that many publishers currently do provide many e-books to universities and colleges. We also believe that having e-text readily available will assist veterans and citizens who have vision loss in pursuing their educational goals, and in this way assist them in becoming more productive members of society. And I'll thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them.
Thank you.
For a moment. Now, I realize we're doing a little bit of theatrics here.
Well, I realize that, but you know what? It's really important that we see this, because
I have two working hands, and I can get quickly to what I need, and I don't realize until Mr. Brown has just showed me, it took him a long time to get to that first page, and then you were so rude to send him back and, you know, he can't do that quickly, and by then the professor's already talking about it and moving along. So
or just the time of studying.
Oh, right. Your point is so well taken.
In the limited hours of the day.
Yeah.
Harry and I have both been disabled for a long time, and we know the shortcuts to do this sort of thing. And there are shortcuts. Unfortunately, there's lots of newer injuries out there. We're both spinal cord injured, and there's lots of newer injuries out there. And these are young people. And as they start to think of what they're going to do with their lives, the only their best recourse is in education. Then they can go back into the workforce. And as they're pursuing that, they haven't had that those years and years of experience. Terry 20, me 30 in the wheelchair. That's a long time. We know the shortcuts. If you're only 3 or 4 years in, you haven't quite adapted yet.
Right. All right. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Appreciate all of your testimony. I really do. We're going to hear from Mr. Gardner from the Publishers Association, and then we'll have some further conversation. Mr. Brown, did you have a comment?
Well, as you know,
did you find your page?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, but you notice that my study area is very small, and the book exceeds it. It's very easy for gravity to take advantage of this book, and there goes my ability to study, do any reading or anything like that, especially when I'm alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
that's a good point.
I've got to find something else to do.
Well, and I'm mindful of Mr. Chittenden telling us that he had to drop out of school in the 80s. No one should have to drop out of school because they don't, they can't access the materials.
Just a bit of background real quick. Maybe Mr. Chittenden can answer this too. It also, back in the 70s, I think it was 73, they passed the Rehabilitation Act. And that required universities receiving federal funds to make their programs and services accessible to disabled students. And that's when we started doing, at the time it was readers, means people would read onto tape, the textbooks onto tape. I remember when I was in college, one of my roommates did that. And we technology has progressed a great deal since then. We now have things we can do electronically we couldn't even dream of back in 1973. We haven't caught up with that yet. All the burden was placed on the universities. Publishers now have the technology available to make the textbooks in an alternative format for the disabled student. We just have to give them a nudge in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Just another interesting note about that. Now, I do not know the specifics about this, but I had a conversation with a disabled person from some country in Europe, a blind person, who told me that out there, the publishers are required to provide the text in ASCII format. There's no arguing. They must provide every text in ASCII format. And with all the major hue and cry that the publishers have been raising about how they're going to lose money, everyone's going to pirate their stuff, I see more people photocopy books than I see people, you know, from Europe who get the electronic text. They keep it private and don't share it.
So in other words, you haven't seen any bootleg texts from Europe?
Oh, no. It's, no, I haven't.
And we get bootleg music, but no bootleg texts.
And there are times when I've looked for it because I need the book and it's not available. So
all right. Well, thank you.
And there was one other point also.
Uh-huh.
It takes approximately, according to the, which I forgot to bring up, it takes the DRC for, because in addition to scanning books, they also have to scan handouts that are passed out, you know, by teachers in classes. And they told me it takes approximately, because you've got to edit it and make sure everything is correct, when you scan it, they can do approximately 6 to 10 pages per hour of the handouts in class. Just as the books, it can take hours and hours to do, especially the more complex books.
Okay.
It can take up to several months.
Sounds like it takes a lot of time and energy. So thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. I'll ask you to step back now, and we will hear from Mr. Gardner. Mr. Gardner, I want to close the public hearing on this at 10 o'clock because we have one more bill I'd like to get to. So if you can summarize, we're not going to move this today. I think we have to have some more conversation about it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Association of American Publishers. We must respectfully oppose the bill as written. However, I would hasten to add that I have indicated to your committee administrator and to Mr. Jundeff that I have requested alternative language from the Association of American Publishers, and I am assured that I will be supplied alternative language based on the New York law. I want to just use this opportunity to quickly go over a few highlights of what is happening right now nationally, because there is enormous progress being made, and I think a year from now we will see a nationally based system in place that that is standardized and will have the ability to accommodate the needs of disabled students, which is a goal that all of us share, certainly the Publishers Association. The national initiative is called the Association of American Publishers Alternative Formats Solution Initiative, and it's intended to create essentially a national database of software that will accommodate in a standardized way, accommodate the needs that we've heard addressed so dramatically by the witnesses. In addition to that, there is a major repository being compiled by the state of California of a number of textbooks, and it is my understanding that the intention of the state of California is to provide licenses to higher education institutions elsewhere in the country. So that will provide another alternative source of access to this needed material. Some of the technical issues with the bill as drafted is one of them is that the default file format standard, if the parties can't agree on whether it should be PDF or Word or ASCII, is what is called NIMAS. That is a standard that was developed for K-12. It is very expensive to convert an ASCII or Word document into that, and one of the flaws of it is that it does not accommodate equations, so you would not be able to get a physics text, for instance, or a chemistry text into that format. Those are just some of the technical issues that we think need to be kind of ironed out before we can come forward to you with a bill that will work. So with that, maybe I should just pause there and indicate that we are going to work on some alternative language, do so expeditiously, run it by Mr. Jundeff, and of course run it by your committee administrator and the committee.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm glad to see that your association is as concerned about this issue. I expected them to be, because we all want people to have knowledge and access to books, and even though that book on thermodynamics wouldn't be something I would be reading, but I assume that someone is studying that and learning to do that. So I appreciate that you're doing that. What is the New York law? Is that,
you, Madam Chair? I wish I knew.
Okay.
But I don't. I'm told that it will be consistent with the national initiative by the association to come up with a standardized format, but hopefully in a week I'll have a lot more information for you.
Okay.
And the committee.
Okay. Well, I'll hold on to this bill then while we await that information. Senator Cruz, you have a question?
Well, just Jim, I guess I'm always interested, if we're going to have national standards, which would be the best solution, so that, I mean, for all concerned, number one, it's transferable from state to state then if a student changes schools. You said, but in here it says, if implemented. So I'd be interested in what the certainty and time frame of that movement is.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I am told that the national initiative is about a year away from pretty solid implementation. The California program is in place, and I believe the New York program is in place. So we do have some precedents that we can build on. One of the challenges is that, in addition to the technical problem I mentioned with the NIMAS standard, which it will not accommodate equations, is that sometimes you will have older material that is not prepared in where the electronic file doesn't exist, and then it becomes a question of is it feasible for the publisher to offer that product for sale if it must be reconverted back manually. But with most of these initiatives focus on new texts where you do have an electronic file.
That's interesting, because I have my degree in political science, and there was a class I took where we read a lot of older books. I mean, I had to get one of mine from Powell's bookstore, and it was very hard to get. So, and it was a little paperback and very small print, and I remember it, and I've not thrown it away. But that's interesting. What do you do with those older texts that are out of print?
Madam Chair, that's exactly right. If it's a used book, for instance, that's going to have to be scanned. That's going to have to be mm-hmm. dealt with by the DSS office.
And we've heard from Mr. Chittenden what the problem is
exactly.
In scanning, which I was not aware of. So I appreciated that information.
So to the extent that you're and having a new book, which of course publishers like to have new books,
right.
The electronic file will exist.
Okay, Senator Cruz, final question.
At one point, I thought I was going to be a political science major as well. But that gets, you talk old book, new book. I mean, one of the basic primers of political science, I assume, still is like Plato's Republic or something like that, which was written a few years ago, but continues to be reprinted. So does that fit in the category of new book from this perspective?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, typically that will have been republished and the electronic file will be available.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. We'll look forward to getting more information and seeing us make progress on this bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 261. Again, I'll announce that we are not hearing 381 today. We're going to hear that on Tuesday. Senate Bill 384 is up next. I will open a public hearing on that. We're going to have Ms. Richardson talk to us about the bill while we get the sign-up sheet. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 384 prohibits school districts, education service districts, or public charter schools from entering a contract that grants an administrator specific benefits, allows the school to make contributions to administrator's retirement plan in lieu of contribution to the PERS, but the contributions may not exceed contributions that would have been made to the PERS. It applies to contracts on or after the effective date of the measure. It declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage. Thank you. Just a little bit of background. This bill was Senate Bill 766 last legislative session. And when I get a bee under my bonnet, I don't stop. And we tried every which way to get this bill through last session. It did pass the Senate. It went into a couple of bills in the House. And actually at 2:30 in the morning on sine die, I was sleeping, taking a nap on my sofa, and got a call that the bill was up. So I went down, but the bill did not go forward. So I brought it back because I think it's an excellent bill. It's all about accountability. And I asked Oregon School Employees Association if they would please testify on the bill again this session. And so I'm going to ask Tricia Smith to come up, and then I'll hear. I'll just ask Tricia to come up first, and then we'll ask all the opponents to come up. And we've got 15 minutes. So do you have your chart? Because I made copies.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do.
Great. Thank you. Introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, which is an independent labor union representing about 20,000 educational staff in Oregon's Head Start agencies, K-12 districts, ESDs, and community colleges, as well as libraries and parks and rec districts. I'm before you today to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 384, which is intended to place reasonable limits on the amount of compensation a school district may provide an administrator or a superintendent when the administrator leaves employment with the district. Senate Bill 384 would prohibit, specifically prohibit, school districts, education service districts, or public charter schools from entering into employment contracts with administrators that provide compensation at the end of the contract that is greater than 25% of the amount of salary and benefits paid to the administrator during the prior school year, or that provide retirement benefits more generous than those offered to other employees of the district. Senate Bill 384 does not restrict the compensation or benefits a district may provide to a superintendent or an administrator during the term of employment. It may seem odd that I'm before you today asking you to restrict the ability of my members' employers to compensate their staffs the way that they choose to. Generally, I would not be doing so. I would be arguing exactly the opposite, that school districts and ESDs are locally elected independent boards. They have their own government, and they should be allowed to make decisions for themselves. Unfortunately, situations have occurred in Oregon that have caused us to ask for these limits. Those situations have created credibility issues with the public and have created anger and distrust among them about our ability to manage money wisely and to do what's in the best interest of children. The credibility crisis that had occurred is what caused OSEA to come to the legislature in the 2005 session and ask for this bill. The bill in the 2005 session, or 05 session, was Senate Bill 766, as the chair mentioned to you. And the chart that I provided with my testimony was the floor statement for Senate Bill 766. So that's why it says Senate Bill 766 on it. When we came to the legislature to ask for this bill, as you, I'm sure, remember, K-12 school districts had lost more than $1 billion in education funding as a result of the recession. Our students were suffering, our schools were suffering, our staffs were suffering all over the state, and it was creating great damage in the educational programs that we were offering to our children. At the same time those cutbacks were happening, way too many communities were rocked by the scandal of learning that their school district board had entered into a contract with an outgoing administrator that would provide him or her sometimes thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars in benefits or money that they would enjoy after they left their term of employment with the district. This practice might have seemed appropriate to the board or district when negotiating the contract in the first place, but it certainly did not seem so to the public when they became aware of it as the administrator was leaving. By placing limits on the amount of salary and benefits that may be awarded to an administrator at the time of, at the end of an employment contract, Senate Bill 384 will bring school districts, ESDs, and charter schools in line with other governmental agencies, which already prohibit this practice. State agency heads and administrators do not enjoy these kinds of benefits, and local governments also do not provide these benefits. To statutorily limit compensation of public employees is a step OSEA would not ordinarily support, as I told you. Most public employee compensation packages are developed through a public negotiating process that few can call overly generous. And the difficulties faced by those who choose a career in education at any level, whether it is a superintendent or a school bus driver, make recruitment and retention of high-quality staff a continuing challenge for all of us. We don't believe, however, that the reasonable limitations set in Senate Bill 384 will negatively impact a school district's ability to attract high-quality staff at the administrative level, but rather it will positively impact the public image of district decision-making when it comes time for those administrators to leave the district. Education dollars are precious and too few for us to waste or appear to waste. We're going to ask the legislature and the taxpayers to continue to invest in our system of public education. We must be able to show to you that we are accountable for that money and we are making good choices. If you provide us this reasonable limitation, we can avoid the situations that you see on my handout and hopefully begin to regain some of that trust that we lost through these incidents. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. I want to
echo your concern about that. I have all my notes. I will warn everyone up front. I have all my notes, so everything you said last session I still have. The file's quite thick, but I came across, as you were testifying, an opinion, an op-ed written by Kristen Granger, who is Vice President and Executive Assistant to President Pelton at Willamette University, and she wrote this on April 14, 2005, and I'm going to quote, "But the administrator should understand that one of the biggest barriers to voter support for increased school funding is the public perception that a huge percentage of school districts' money is being spent on administration. I'm inclined to think that even if it has mostly symbolic value, a law limiting, quote, exit bonuses might help address that perception. The belief that administrative costs are out of control is widespread. Even in, quote, liberal Portland, a poll last year showed that 70% of voters thought too much money was being spent on administration, and the Chalkboard Project statewide surveys have had similar results." And she's right. She's exactly right. And that's why the Open Books Project was created, to show people what was actually being spent on administration. But this isn't a perceived problem. This was an actual problem, as the chart shows. We have not had any this year that I've seen, but it's an actual problem. And the bill was amended last session because of testimony from the folks who we'll hear from next, and I thought we addressed the problem. So that's why the bill is back before us, and I thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, and thank you for your comments. I guess my question would focus from the perspective of how do you deal with an administrator that's either incompetent or just isn't working, and it's to no one's advantage for someone that is not performing to stay on the job. If this bill were to go into effect, how would the school boards and ESDs, how would they successfully terminate an administrator without the risk of possibly court-driven settlements that could be quite high?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, thank you for the question. I believe that school districts could manage this, first of all, at the beginning of the contract when they are negotiating the contract. What you are asking is, shouldn't districts be allowed to buy out a contract of an incompetent administrator to get rid of him? I would suggest that they should treat administrators the way they treat my members, who are secretaries and educational assistants and bus drivers. When they are incompetent, they are removed from their position. And there is no thought of buying them out of a period of time of employment. And I think the same should be true of administrators. And if the contracts are written with the criteria that they expect for performance within them, then I see no reason they should feel some great risk of liability for terminating a contract when those conditions are not met. On the other hand, let me add one thing. If an administrator does have those conditions and expectations fully outlined in their contract, and a district decides to eliminate his employment anyway, then, like our members, I believe that administrator should have some cause of action to appeal that decision. So if we're talking about incompetent administrators, I don't think we should have to buy them out of their contract.
Questions?
As a follow-up, thank you for your comments. In the case of most disputes, there's always two sides to an issue.
Absolutely.
And it may or may not be the administrator's fault, and maybe it's a distributed fault. And if a board did not have the ability to look at the lesser of costs in the event of a claim, and it goes through the courts, you know, we could wind up with the costs actually greater than the settlement, because there's always the risk of how the courts would interpret the dispute.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I certainly sympathize with that and acknowledge that absolutely exists, and it's a very delicate balance that boards must
must traverse to assure that they are managing their money wisely and they are managing their personnel wisely. I would say to you, though, that I don't think it's much different between whether or not their employee is an administrator or another employee in terms of how they have to manage that. Willamette Education Service District in the last 18 months or so had yet another public scandal over how it handled the contracts of administrators that they were trying to remove from their positions. And the issue was not whether or not they should be removing them, but how much they paid them to get rid of them. And while I understand from an administrative and an internal standpoint, having served on city councils and in the Senate, and particularly my city council experience, where in executive session we often had to weigh the costs of litigation versus the cost of settlement, still, when it gets to the public isn't that... They are not using that kind of finesse in their analysis of the situation. And what we end up doing, in our opinion, is saving pennies and losing millions in support from the public.
Just as a comment, Madam Chair, I share your perception, and when we have public funds, we're held to a higher standard.
Yes, sir.
And it seems that that standard has been breached in some of these instances. My concern, though, it has to do with actually an unintended consequence of possibly greater cost of public funds without the ability to make choices for school boards. So I share. Mm-hmm. You just feel badly when you see these settlements. They don't appear to be right, but they may be right in the bigger context of what the cost could be without that kind of a settlement.
Well, Senator Morse, I appreciate that comment, and we're going to close our hearing today. In a moment, because we've run out of time, but one of the cases on the back of this chart you saw last session was giving Skip Lieber, it's the superintendent of the Willamette ESD, a luxury-owned vehicle valued at $26,000 for $7,900. That's not anything that I think was necessary to exit this man from his contract, and the text next to that will tell you in greater detail about that, but Ms. Smith was accurate about that too. I made a complaint about Willamette ESD once again last year for some behavior, and actually was found by the Government Standards and Practices Commission to be a valid complaint. So we're going to have to close the hearing today, and I apologize to those of you who've waited. It's 10:15, but you're around the building all the time, and it will give you time to lobby the committee if you wish. If you have written materials you'd like to have us look at now, that would be great, but we're going to carry this over. It will be first up on our agenda on Tuesday. You won't be here, Mr. Green?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Then I will hold. Will you be back Thursday? Then I will hold it to Thursday because you want to testify. And it will be first up on our agenda next Thursday. Is that February 1st?
Yes.
Shoot.
We've got a full day.
It can't be February 1st because we're hearing the insurance pool bill that
day. You could move that bill.
Day. No, I'm sorry. That one's already been scheduled. So, darn it, we're going to have to go another.
Let's just put them in one bill, Madam Chair.
Well, that might work. Well, shoot, I wanted to move, but I'm going to give deference to you, Mr. Green, because you're gone, and you have a viewpoint that needs to be heard. So it will actually be another week before we get back to this bill because of our commitments. But it will be first up, and it will be given all due time on the agenda. So, colleagues, thanks very much for your attention. I'll adjourn the public hearing on Senate Bill 384. I almost called it by the other number. And I want to remind you that we are going to be in Reedsport tomorrow. We start at 9:30, though there's a continental breakfast at 9 a.m.
And they're expecting quite a large group of people to come out and see us in action, and I expect you to be there. So with that, I'll close the committee. Thank you. We're adjourned.